moment with all of the remembered patterns and habits we possess. These, in turn, help us anticipate and move into the future. We can connect Augustine's idea with a point from Gadamer. When it comes to knowing and interpreting reality, prejudgments are a kind of memory we can't do without. Through our prejudgments, what has happened in the past affects how we approach the present and how we view the future. When we realize that prejudgments function almost like memory, we can see why Gadamer connects them with tradition, a word that comes to us in English from a Latin verb that means to pass down from the past. In our prejudgments, memory is first of all personal, our personal past experiences, how we're raised and educated, what happens to us growing up, which responses seem to work for us, mould who we become. The way Hermione values books and education was no doubt shaped by her well-educated parents. The older Weasley twins' shenanigans, not to mention Mr. Weasley's penchant for tinkering with Muggle artifacts, likely bolster Ron's understanding that rules are easily bent and meant to be broken. Memory, however, is also thoroughly social in nature. In the broadest sense, memory isn't only the traces of past events and personal experiences that we carry around in our heads. Memory also includes all of the traces of the past handed down to us within our language and culture, our artifacts and institutions. These, too, mould the intellectual habits, assumptions, and expectations we use to interpret our world and move forward in knowledge, often in ways we're not even aware of. In Rowling's novels, it's the pensieve that symbolizes the power of memory, both individually and socially, and its much-needed role in communicating and forming knowledge. In fact, when Dumbledore explains the pensieve, he describes its primary function as epistemological, to preserve and organize knowledge. Dumbledore remarks that he sometimes has too many thoughts and memories crammed into his mind. With a pensieve, a person simply siphons the excess thoughts from one's mind, pours them into the basin, and examines them at one's leisure. Not only are the thoughts and the experiences preserved, but it becomes easier to spot patterns and links when they are in this form. The pensieve allows its users to step back and look more observantly at themselves in order to gain a fresh perspective. The pensieve isn't only for personal use, however. It also makes memory available to others, reminding us that memory is at root a social phenomenon. Through the pensieve's magic, Dumbledore puts Harry in contact with past events he otherwise would never have known about, and these events provide evidence and context that bump up against Harry's assumptions, provide insight into those around him, and help him to better understand the threats and the opportunities he encounters. Most of Harry's experiences with the pensieve occur under Dumbledore's direction, and provide Harry with information he needs to understand and vanquish Voldemort. Thus, Harry learns of Tom Riddle's childhood as an orphan, his youthful sadism, his promise as a pupil, and his self-loathing that led him to murder his Muggle family and to buy into pure-blood ideology. Harry also learns how Riddle sought immortality, even though it required terrible acts of evil to split his soul and preserve its pieces through dark magic. In addition, the pensieve presents reconstructed memories, extracted only with difficulty from Hoki and Morfin Gaunt. Hoki was the house elf who worked for Hepzibah Smith, from whom Voldemort obtained Slytherin's locket and Hufflepuff's cup. Morfin was Merope's brother, the uncle of Voldemort, whom the young Riddle framed for the murder of his Muggle father and grandparents. With each additional memory, Harry gains more insight into Voldemort's history and character, his past and present activities, and, most important, his vulnerabilities. Just as Dudley needed true beliefs to replace his false ones, Harry needed a fuller picture of Riddle and his history, as well as crucial details about Snape's life, to discover how to defeat the Dark Lord. Moving past misdirection. In each book of the series, Rowling allows Harry's prejudgments and those of the other characters to lead them to false interpretations of their world. But when enough tension builds and enough evidence piles up, it alters their prejudgments until they're forced to fit reality. Dumbledore's dreams of wizard supremacy evaporate when his relationship with Grindelwald leads to his sister's death. Merope's desire for Tom Riddle's love dissolves into despair when she stops using the love potion and he abandons her. Ron comes to his senses as soon as he's away from Harry and Hermione and the influence of the Horcrux. Even the Malfoys begin to see Voldemort for what he truly is, once Voldemort's own ambitions threaten the life of their son, Draco. Most of all, Harry transforms. When we first meet him, he's a naive and hesitant kid, just entering the wizarding world, full of curiosity and questions. Although he's open to learning, he's sometimes led astray or beyond his abilities by his loyalty to friends, disregard for rules, and desire for a sense of importance and belonging. Later, Harry grows into an impetuous and headstrong teenager, often cocky in his own insights and quick to dismiss both friends and authorities he should trust. Through mistakes, tragedies, and struggles, Harry eventually matures into a remarkably courageous young man, able to discern what's happening and what must be done. Right knowledge and good intellectual habits are necessary not only to get the facts straight, but also to exercise virtues such as bravery, loyalty, and generosity. Harry can't be truly brave, after all, unless he understands the nature of the danger confronting him, what sort of confidence he must marshal in the face of it, and whose future depends on his actions. Likewise, true loyalty to Dumbledore isn't a matter of minimizing his real faults or clinging to a false, idealized image of who Dumbledore is. Rather, it is to understand that despite Dumbledore's known faults, his missteps, and his failure to disclose key information, his motives and judgment are worthy of trust. And so, personal transformation of character depends on moving past misjudgments, being open to correction, and cultivating a growing sensitivity to what is right and true. In this way, epistemology is inseparable from ethics. What Harry and his friends go through as characters, we also experience as readers, because Rowling invites us to see Harry's world largely through his eyes. Although we may sometimes see beyond Harry's limited horizon before Harry himself does, Rowling uses narrative misdirection in ways that reinforce our mistaken assumptions and guide us away from crucial questions. Many of our prejudgments remain unchallenged, and we too, along with Harry, go through a process of discovery and reinterpretation on the way to knowledge. And, returning to where we began, if a person such as Dudley Dursley can come to appreciate Harry, there's good hope for even the most resistant and unsympathetic of readers. The genius of Rowling's work lies not only in its powerful storytelling, but also in its power to change us as readers. If we allow Rowling's magic to work on us, it will engage, challenge, and transform our intellectual habits. As we follow Harry and the other characters, we don't merely become better readers, we become better people. Chapter 13. Just in Your Head? J.K. Rowling on Separating Reality from Illusion. John Granger with Gregory Basham. There are many ways to unlock the hidden mysteries of the Harry Potter books, but in this chapter, we'll consider one key in particular. It comes right near the end of J.K. Rowling's 7-part series, and Rowling herself says that she waited 17 years to use 2 lines in particular. So, if there is a key to find, this is a good place to look. "Yes, that's right," she said. "All this time I've worked to be able to write those 2 phrases, writing Harry entering the forest and Harry having that dialogue." So what are those 2 lines, and what is their philosophical significance? Tell me one last thing. After Harry sacrifices himself and awakens in the limbo King's Cross, in his last moments of conversation with Albus Dumbledore, he asks, "Tell me one last thing," said Harry. "Is this real? Or has this been happening inside my head?" Dumbledore beamed at him, and his voice sounded loud and strong in Harry's ears, even though the bright mist was descending again, obscuring his figure.
"Of course it is happening inside your head, Harry. But why on earth should that mean that it is not real?"
Rowling's remarkable claim is that she's been writing the 4,100-plus-page series to arrive at just this point, so that Harry could hear these two phrases, "Of course it is happening inside your head," and "Why on earth should that mean that it is not real?" These lines are among the most philosophically interesting in the entire series as well, so they provide the ideal chance to explore both their significance to the story and their deeper import. What is real? Harry's question is a profoundly philosophical one. Questions about what is real lie at the heart of the philosophical quest. The branch of philosophy called metaphysics asks just these questions. Do souls exist, or God, or numbers? These are metaphysical questions, for they deal with the issue of what is ultimately real. The goal of metaphysics is to break free from mere appearances and capture the reality, to replace opinions with knowledge. Metaphysics asks what is real, whereas the branch of philosophy called epistemology is about how we can come to know what is real, so that we're not confusing what is unreal or illusory with what is genuine reality. It's only natural that Harry should wonder how real his experience was. For we all can be deceived by experiences that seem real but aren't. All of us are vulnerable to wishful thinking, biased perspectives, and other sorts of flawed judgment that can mislead us into mistaking appearance for reality. Perhaps this is why the famous atheist, A.J. Eyre, after having a vivid near-death experience near the end of his life, remained unmoved afterward, choosing to chalk it up as a hallucination rather than as a genuine experience of a transcendent reality. Harry, too, wonders whether his experience is real or simply made up. Long before Dumbledore and Harry explored a dark and particularly creepy cave together, Plato, 428 to 348 BCE, offered an image of a cave that has stood as an example of what philosophy is all about. Plato asks us to picture men chained inside a cave all of their lives, able to see only flickering images on the wall cast by a fire behind them. Understandably, they take those shadows to be reality, rather than imperfect reflections of real things. But one day, a man is released from his chains and makes his way out of the cave. At first, he's blinded by the dazzling light, but eventually he's able to see the world as it really is. He realizes that all of his life he's been mistaking mere appearances for realities, wavering images on a cave wall for the real world. Wanting to share his wonderful revelation with his fellows, the prisoner returns to the cave, but is greeted with hostile skepticism by the captives. Plato was convinced that our entire earthly pilgrimage takes place in a world of appearances, and that ultimate reality comes later. The philosopher's job is to raise people's sights to these deeper realities, helping people stop confusing shadows and appearances for authentic reality. Even before Plato, philosophers grappled with questions of what is real and how we come to know reality. So, Harry's question of what is real is at root a philosophical query, and the distinction he raises between real and in the head provides a useful starting point for our discussion. Going mental. We can easily distinguish things that exist only in our heads from things that exist both in our heads and in the external world. Hermione Granger, for example, as a fictional character, exists in our heads, but not in reality. Likewise, Sherlock Holmes, Santa Claus, unicorns and centaurs. Emma Watson, Oxford and King's Cross Station, on the other hand, aren't mere ideas in our minds, but actual persons, places and things that exist in reality. Although we might have the idea of Oxford in our minds, Oxford itself has an objective, independent reality that purely fictional ideas do not. So, although the idea of a thing and the thing itself may both exist, to say of something that it exists in the head often means in the head alone, and so not in external reality. Harry's question isn't straightforwardly silly or stupid, in other words. He was concerned that his dialogue with Dumbledore had merely been a dream or a hallucination, a shadowy image on the cave wall. Dumbledore's reply, then, is telling. He doesn't deny that Harry's experience has been in his head, but he insists that this doesn't mean that it isn't real. Harry's question, in other words, is based on a false choice, either in the head or real. Harry has taken the two options to be exhaustive and mutually exclusive. The truth of one means the falsehood of the other. But Dumbledore assures him that they aren't inconsistent at all. Mental experiences can also be real. A number of philosophers through the centuries have had a similar insight, which is what makes Dumbledore's claim so philosophically fascinating. Let's consider a few of these examples from the history of philosophy. Plato's idea has already been mentioned, so let's start with him. He was a rationalist, who thought all knowledge is rooted in reason rather than in sense perception. Why? Because reason puts us in touch with what Plato believed is ultimately real, the forms. Consider broomsticks. In Harry's world, we see various and sundry broomsticks, but what makes them broomsticks at all, according to what Plato says, is that they resemble imperfectly the ideal platonic form or abstract essence of what a broomstick is. Our senses only put us in touch with imperfect copies, not with the platonic ideal. Reason is how we get in touch with what's ultimately real. If Plato were to hear a disgruntled philosophy student complaining about having to leave class and go into the real world, he might suggest that we're never more in touch with the real world than when we're thinking philosophically. Plato is not the only Western philosopher to claim that true reality can be known only through reason. The great French rationalist philosopher, René Descartes, 1596 to 1650, argued that the essences of both material things and minds cannot be known by sense experience, but only by rational analysis. The German philosopher, Immanuel Kant, 1724 to 1804, argued that physical objects such as rocks, chairs and trees are mental constructs that result from the interaction of our shaping and categorizing minds with external reality. Absolute idealists, such as G.W.F. Hegel, 1770 to 1831, and neo-Hegelians, such as F.H. Bradley, 1846 to 1924, went even further than Kant in stressing the ultimacy of mind and spiritual values. Similar views are found in some strands of British empiricism. For empiricists, sense experience, not reason, is the source of all human knowledge. The British empiricist George Berkeley, 1685 to 1753, is famous for his immaterialist view that physical objects don't exist at all, but are merely ideas in the minds of God and other perceivers. Berkeley believed that for all external things like clouds and mountains, to be is to be perceived. So all of what we experience as external reality is, in a sense, in the head, but is no less real as a consequence. Two centuries later, the British empiricist John Stuart Mill, 1806 to 1873, defended a phenomenalist account of human knowing, according to which all talk of material reality can be cashed out as talk of actual or possible sensory experiences. Such views are also found in a variety of Eastern philosophical traditions, including some schools of Hinduism, Buddhism, and Taoism. For example, Yogacara Buddhists believe that everything humans experience as real is fabricated by consciousness, and thus is sunya, empty, and lacking in any definite nature or essence. Whether the mind creates reality, in whole or in part, or puts us in touch with an already existing reality, or corresponds in some sense with an independent reality, philosophers from a broad spectrum of views would agree with Dumbledore's point that what's real and what's in the head aren't necessarily at odds. Rowling as an inkling. Now let's explore a suggestive possibility that Rowling may have had in mind when she wrote this exchange between Harry and Dumbledore. It doesn't presuppose that she was staking out well-defined territory among the murky thickets of metaphysics, but it does potentially shed light on questions of what reality is like and how we can come to know it. This interpretation depends on taking seriously Rowling's claim that she was heavily influenced by C.S. Lewis and his fellow inklings, such as J.R.R. Tolkien. The inklings were a group of Oxford dons and their friends who met regularly to discuss one another's writings and other matters, often at the Eagle and Child, an Oxford pub. Among the inklings were Owen Barfield, Tolkien, Charles Williams, Lewis's brother Warney, and other well-known Oxford figures. Rowling has spoken of her debt to Lewis in particular, attributing her decision to write seven books to Lewis's seven-part Chronicles of Narnia, which she loved as a child. To be sure, the Potter books are quite different from the Narnia books. Nowhere is Rowling nearly so obvious in promoting a particular religious message, to the extent that she does. I have argued that it's through symbol and form, implicit more than explicit, and not at all heavy-handed. Still, she has admitted that what helped inspire the stories was her personal struggle to hold on to faith, and she claims to be a Christian whose religious convictions, if known, would have made much of the storyline predictable. So it wouldn't be surprising to find indicators of such influences within the stories. What could account for the fit between the content of our minds and the real world? Why are our best philosophical insights windows into reality? How is it that reason is so successful in putting us in touch with the truth? For an intriguing possibility, consider this quote from Lewis, in which he laid out a big lesson he learned from his friend Barfield. Lewis said that Barfield convinced me that the materialistic positions we had hitherto held left no room for any satisfactory theory of knowledge. We had been, in the technical sense of the term, realists. That is, we accepted as rock-bottom reality the universe revealed by the senses. But at the same time, we continued to make, for certain phenomena of consciousness, all the claims that really went with a theistic or idealistic view. We maintained that abstract thought, if obedient to logical rules, gave indisputable truth, that our moral judgment was valid, and our aesthetic experience not merely pleasing, but valuable. Barfield convinced me that it was inconsistent. If thought were a purely subjective event, these claims for it would have been abandoned. I was therefore compelled to give up realism. I must admit that mind was no late-come epiphenomenon, that the whole universe was, in the last resort, mental, that our logic was participation in a cosmic logos. Some readers might recognize here the germ of the argument Lewis would later develop in his 1947 book, Miracles, his so-called argument from reason. It was on this very topic that Lewis had his famous debate with the philosopher Elizabeth Anscombe, 1919-2001, a debate that required Lewis to amend the chapter. Alvin Plantinga, a leading Christian philosopher, has recently offered an argument from reason against naturalism that owes much to Lewis. The basic idea of the argument is that for us to retain confidence in the deliverances of reason, we must be warranted in thinking that rationality is more than merely subjective. Rather, rationality must somehow be able to put us in touch with external reality. If the reasons we hold various views are merely because those convictions were formed through a naturalistic process according to the laws of nature, there's not necessarily any good basis for taking our conclusions as reliably true. It's not my aim to assess this argument here, but to mention it as a line of reasoning that might have influenced Rowling. It might provide some insight into the overlap between reality and what's in our head. Note the way that Lewis thought of reality as mental, and our logic as participation in a larger structure of rationality within the universe. As a Christian, he was inclined to cash this out as participation in the divine logos, by which a Christian means Christ himself. Jesus, as depicted in John chapter 1 verse 1, is the incarnation of the divine logos, the word from which we derive our word, logic. Some early Greek philosophers conceived of logos as the impersonal animating principle that upholds reality. Later, Greek and Roman Stoic philosophers saw logos as the divine reason that pervades and providentially guides the cosmos. When John the Evangelist came along and announced that Jesus was the incarnation of the Logos, he was espousing something radical. His point, expressed in language that would have been understood in that context, was that there is indeed a divine Logos by which reality takes its shape and is held in existence. But the Logos is no mere animating principle or impersonal force, but a person, God the Son. According to this view, human reason and logic, our capacity to engage in critical reflection and rational thought, are possible and reliable because through the right use of our minds, we are participating in the divine logos. As Rowling has remarked in an interview, it wasn't a coincidence that Harry's fateful encounter with Dumbledore was at King's Cross. Lewis's point about the divine logos raises another suggestive possibility for making sense of Dumbledore's connection between what's real and what's in the head. The suggestion is about both metaphysics and epistemology. How our minds work inexplicably seems intimately related to the way the world is. If we're going to avoid various skeptical hypotheses, something has to account for the conspicuous overlap between external reality and the functioning of human rationality. As so often happens with philosophy, what at first seems an obvious connection yields on reflection a picture that may illustrate some of life's bigger mysteries. Harry's near-death experience. Dumbledore's remark that things can be real even if they occur only in one's head happens as part of Harry's near-death experience in King's Cross. Nowhere is the difference between what's real and what's in the head posed more starkly than in near-death experiences. It's worth exploring such experiences as an additional clue to Rowling's meaning. The current interest in near-death experiences, NDEs, began with a publication in 1975 of Raymond Moody's best-selling book, Life After Life. In that book, Moody documented the experiences of more than 100 people who had been declared clinically dead or had come close to death and had then been revived. Since Moody's book appeared, an enormous amount of research has been done on NDEs. For the most part, this research has supported Moody's findings. Studies have found that NDEs are relatively common. About 10 to 20% of people who survive cardiac arrest report lucid, structured NDEs. That they tend to be basically similar in people of all ages, backgrounds and cultures, and that they often have many of the characteristic features Moody describes. Based on the studies to date, researchers have identified the following core features of NDEs. 1. Feelings of peace and serenity. 2. A buzzing or ringing noise. 3. Separation from the body. 4. An experience of moving rapidly down a dark tunnel. 5. Meeting and being welcomed by others, usually departed friends or family. 6. Encountering a welcoming and loving being of light. 7. An instantaneous life review. 8. A barrier or a border marking a separation of earthly existence from the other side. 9. Reluctance to come back to one's body. Studies have shown that these elements tend to occur in this order, and that the first few features occur more commonly than the others. Are near-death experiences real in the sense of being genuinely paranormal glimpses of a post-mortem world? Skeptics point to two major problems with this interpretation. First, as the leading NDE researcher, Susan Blackmore, notes, NDEs are by no means always the same. Some people have terrifying hell-like experiences. Only a small percentage of NDEs report seeing a light, meeting others, or experiencing a panoramic life review. Some NDEs report having a greyish, transparent, astral body, while others do not. Children often report being met by living playmates, or even animals, rather than by deceased relatives or a being of light. And people of different religious backgrounds often report meeting religious figures or receiving messages that are unique to their own religious traditions. Second, even if NDEs are often consistent in basic details, this doesn't mean the experiences are genuinely paranormal. As Blackmore argues, it might only mean that we have similar brains that react in similar ways to the physical and psychological stresses of dying. For instance, she notes, lack of oxygen to the brain can produce many of the same effects as NDEs, including loud ringing or buzzing noises, sensations of floating, out-of-body experiences, and bright lights. Do such objections demonstrate conclusively that NDEs are not real? No. As Rowling's tale of Harry's near-death experience in King's Cross shows very well. Suppose a child has an NDE in which her pet dog, Sparky, greets and welcomes her to the other side. Sparky is still living, So the child must simply be hallucinating, right? Not necessarily. For the experience might be real, in the sense of being a genuine divinely created vision of the other side. The vision could be true, real, in the sense of being an authentic supernatural revelation, not unlike Paul's vision on the road to Damascus. In other words, in asking whether an NDE is real, we aren't necessarily asking whether it is a genuine out-of-body experience of another world. An NDE can be real, i.e., genuinely supernatural and revelatory, even if it takes place entirely inside the head of the person having the experience. It is this ambiguity of the term real that Dumbledore is playing on when he tells Harry that an experience isn't necessarily unreal just because it's happening inside one's head. Elsewhere, I have defended an iconographic reading of the Potter books that sees Harry as a symbol of the noetic or spiritual faculty of the soul. In this reading, the way station King's Cross is a real place, namely, Logos Land or Heaven. Hence, for example, Harry's ability to create objects there and his apparent semi-omniscience. Yet, in asking whether Harry's experience is real or not, the crucial question isn't where Dumbledore and Harry are meeting, but whether it's really Dumbledore who is speaking to Harry. After all, in the wizarding world, wizards can channel themselves through their portraits, imprint their former selves in ghostly form, possess other minds, and probe other wizards' thoughts through legitimacy. So, why shouldn't Dumbledore really be present to Harry's mind, even if Harry, felled by Voldemort's killing curse, hasn't left his body but is still lying semi-conscious on the forest floor? The American poet-philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, "Our faith comes in moments. Yet there is a depth in those moments which constrains us to ascribe more reality to them than to all other experiences." In the same way, perhaps, Rowling is saying, "Don't be dismissive of hints and glimpses of the divine just because they occur in your head." If love really is the most powerful force in the universe, as Rowling thinks, where else would it speak to us, if not in our heads? Chapter 14. A Pensieve for Your Thoughts. Harry Potter and the Magic of Memory. Amy Kind. I sometimes find, and I am sure you know the feeling, that I simply have too many thoughts and memories crammed into my mind. Albus Dumbledore. Of all the magical instruments available in the wizarding world, the Pensieve is one of the most intriguing. As important as the Deluminator was for Ron Weasley, and the Sword of Gryffindor was for Harry, I'd have been hoping for the Pensieve, had Dumbledore singled me out when writing his last will and testament. Although it's not much to look at, just a shallow basin covered with runes and symbols, the Pensieve allows you to offload your memories from your mind as easily as you offload data from your hard drive. It must be wonderfully liberating to be able to literally get something off your mind, at least for a time, to keep from obsessing over what you should have said or done, to stop endlessly replaying a moment of embarrassment, or simply to gain some distance from a particularly disturbing experience. And it must be wonderfully illuminating to be able to review your own memories from an external perspective at your leisure, in the clear light of a new day. As Dumbledore explains to Harry, when you review thoughts and memories in the Pensieve, it becomes easier to spot the patterns and links among them. Yet, it's not only the Pensieve's potential for improving peace and clarity of mind that makes it so special. Even folks like Muggles and Squibs, who don't have magical powers, can achieve something similar through meditation or medication. Rather, the real intrigue of the Pensieve lies in its philosophical implications for the boundaries of mind, memory, and the self. We typically view an individual's memory as a fundamental part of her own identity, and philosophers have even attempted to understand a person's continuing existence through time in terms of memory and mind. But our understanding of what and where the mind is gets called into question if thoughts can be easily extracted from it, tampered with, stored elsewhere, and even discarded. And whose mind is it once thoughts are shared with someone else? A swirling, silvery mass. The powers of mind and memory are mysterious enough even without the magical possibilities opened up by the wizarding world. While I was watching the movie In Bruges recently, it drove me crazy that no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't remember why the actor playing the main character, Ken, looked so familiar to me. Much later, the answer finally popped into my head. It was Brendan Gleeson, the same actor who plays Alistair Mad-Eye Moody in the Harry Potter films. Often, it's when we stop thinking about something that we finally figure it out. Why can we remember all sorts of useless information while the things that we want to remember slip through the cracks, no matter how hard we try to recall them? Why does memory work in such quirky ways? Science has solved many of the mysteries of memory, but it's staggering how much we still don't understand. In fact, we don't really understand the mind itself, either what it is or how it's related to the brain. Severus Snape is right on target when he tells Harry that the mind is a complex and many-layered thing, Potter, or at least most minds are. Philosophers who study the mind have long been divided into two camps. The materialists, in the tradition of the British philosopher Thomas Hobbes, 1588-1679, believe that everything that exists must be a physical thing made of matter and existing in space. Certain inhabitants of the Wizarding World, such as Nearly Headless Nick and other ghosts, might seem to pose a problem for materialism. But the materialist can accept the existence of ghosts as long as they're made of matter. Perhaps not solid matter, but some kind of matter nonetheless. Likewise for the mind. Materialists typically claim that the mind is a material thing and that there is no distinction between the mind and the brain. Some of the descriptions in the Harry Potter books point in the direction of materialism. Consider, for example, the descriptions of thoughts clinging to wands like strands of hair and leaking out of dying wizards like oozing blood. Dualists, in the tradition of the great French philosopher René Descartes, 1596-1650, believe that in addition to material substances, there are also immaterial substances, things that have no spatial extension or location. According to the dualist view, the brain, which is made of matter, falls into the first category, whereas the mind, which isn't made of matter, falls into the second. The common idea that the mind could, theoretically at least, exist without the body presupposes this dualist view. Harry considers this possibility when he finds himself in what seems like King's Cross Station after Voldemort tries to kill him in the Forbidden Forest. Although he ultimately concludes that he must still have his body because he was lying, definitely lying, on some surface, he initially thinks that he might exist only as a disembodied thought. The dualist recognizes that there are close connections between the brain and the mind. Descartes himself claimed that, "I am not merely present in my body as a sailor is present in a ship. I am very closely joined and, as it were, intermingled with it, so that I and the body form a unit." But this intermingling of mind and body doesn't change the fact that for the dualist, they're fundamentally different kinds of things. Many of us have conflicting intuitions that pull us sometimes toward dualism, sometimes toward materialism. On the one hand, it's hard to understand what it would mean for something to be completely immaterial. On the other hand, thoughts do seem to be more ephemeral and intangible than other material objects, such as tables and chairs. J.K. Rowling herself seems caught up in the same tension. Her description of Harry's impression of the contents of the Pensieve when he first comes across it in Dumbledore's office provides a beautifully compelling expression of the push and pull between these two views of the mind and the desire to find some middle ground between them. It was a bright, whitish silver, and it was moving ceaselessly. The surface of it became ruffled like water beneath wind, and then, like clouds, separated and swirled smoothly. It looked like light made liquid, or like wind made solid. Harry couldn't make up his mind. The Hallows of the Mind. Whether we're dualists or materialists, however, there's a strong inclination to think of a mind as self-contained. Someone might transcribe her innermost secrets in a journal or a blog, but assuming that she's not engaged in dark magic, these transcriptions serve simply as records of her memories. That's what makes Tom Riddle's diary so unusual, even in the wizarding world. As Dumbledore says to Harry,
"Well,
although I did not see the riddle who came out of the diary, what you described to me was a phenomenon I had never witnessed. A mere memory starting to act and think for itself. A mere memory sapping the life out of the girl into whose hands it had fallen. No, something much more sinister had lived inside that book. A fragment of soul. I was almost sure of it. The diary had been a horcrux.
We leave post-it notes scattered around the house to help us remember things, and we key all sorts of important information into our BlackBerries. But no matter how dependent someone is on a PDA, the device is still a memory aid, not a memory repository. We don't consider our diaries and iPhone contact lists to be similar to the Pensieve. Recently, however, some philosophers have questioned this traditional way of looking at the limits of the mind. In their article, The Extended Mind, Andy Clark and David Chalmers reject the claim that the mind is framed by the boundaries of skull and skin. Although their article was written more than a decade ago, in the pre-BlackBerry age of the Filofax, even then it was easy to find interesting cases of cognitive reliance on external objects. Most of us can do long division only with the aid of pen and paper, and when playing Scrabble, we do far better at coming up with seven-letter words by physically reshuffling the letter tiles in our trays. Although it's natural to see these external objects as playing the role of environmental supports, Clark and Chalmers suggest that they often function in more than simply a supporting role. Often, our use of external objects can be seen not only as a kind of action, but as a part of thought. Clark and Chalmers propose the radical view that our mental lives need not be solely internal. Rather, the mind extends into the world. We already accept that the body can extend beyond its natural limits. For example, it's not at all far-fetched to suppose that a prosthetic leg becomes part of an amputee's body, not merely an artificial accessory to it. More controversially, consider a wizard who has a particularly strong relationship with his wand, as Harry does to his 11-inch wand made of holly with a phoenix feather core. Harry is so in sync with his wand that he might view it literally as an extension of his own body. We might even see Rita Skeeter's relationship with her Quick Quotes quill the same way. And certainly Moody's magic eye and Peter Pettigrew's silver hand have become parts of their bodies. Similarly, an external object might become a mental prosthesis, extending the mind beyond its natural limits. Rowling's description of thoughts in the Wizarding World makes the idea of an extended mind even more plausible. The gossamer strands of memory belonging to Snape might be inside his skull, leaking out from his body, bottled up in a file, or stored in the Pensieve. But wherever they are, these memories are Snape's, just as the memories in Riddle's diary are Voldemort's. Their physical location is incidental to their ownership. But what about in the non-wizarding world? To make their case for the extended mind idea, Clark and Chalmers give the example of Otto, an individual suffering from Alzheimer's. Otto relies on a notebook to help him remember things. He writes down any new information that he learns, and when he needs to recall something, he consults his notebook. This notebook is always at hand, and he's able to retrieve the information inside it immediately and efficiently. According to Clark and Chalmers, Otto's notebook serves the same purpose as a biological memory. We call things up from memory, while Otto calls things up from his notebook. We keep our beliefs in our minds, while Otto keeps his on paper. Confundus. At first, the extended mind theory may sound like something from a Quibbler story, hatched by Xenophilius Lovegood. If it were described to Ron, I can easily imagine him saying, no pun intended, that's mental. But it begins to make sense when we distinguish between what philosophers call occurrent and non-occurrent beliefs. At any given time, the overwhelming majority of a person's beliefs are not consciously available. Ron believes that Ireland won its match against Bulgaria at the 422nd Quidditch World Cup, but presumably that belief isn't at the forefront of his mind, it's not occurrent, while he and Hermione are racing to the Chamber of Secrets to retrieve the remaining basilisk fang during the Battle of Hogwarts. At that point, all of his occurrent beliefs most likely concern the great danger of his present situation, the fastest path to Moaning Myrtle's bathroom, and how he's going to manage to say open in parcel tongue, a language he doesn't speak. Similarly, because the information in Otto's notebook isn't in the forefront of his mind, it doesn't seem at all analogous to our current beliefs. Rather, it functions like our non-occurrent beliefs. Consider Rita Skeeter's non-occurrent belief that Batilda Bagshot lives in Godric's Hollow, which is stored somewhere in her memory, waiting to be accessed. When Rita decides to interview Batilda in order to gather material for The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore, she must pause to think for a moment to recall where Batilda lives. It's only then that the belief becomes a current. Likewise, suppose that Otto has his old friend Batilda's address written in his notebook. When he decides to visit her, he has to take a moment to look up in his notebook where she lives. His belief is stored somewhere inside the notebook, waiting to be accessed. Just as it would be silly to deny that even before she consults her memory, Rita has the belief that Batilda lives in Godric's Hollow, we should accept that Otto has the same belief even before he consults his notebook. Clark and Chalmers don't go so far as to claim that every external support we rely on becomes part of the mind. Rather, they see something special in Otto's connection to his notebook. It's not the same as Harry's reliance on the marginal notes of the Half-Blood Prince in the potions textbook he borrows from Horace Slughorn, or Neville Longbottom's dependence on a handwritten list to help him remember the frequently changing passwords when Sir Cadogan substitutes for the Fat Lady in guarding the entrance to the Gryffindor common room. Harry's use of the textbook and Neville's use of the list both occur only sporadically, and Neville even ends up losing his list. Otto's connection to his notebook is not even like Hermione Granger's reliance on Hogwarts or history. Although Hermione consults the book regularly, and even ends up bringing it along on the search for Voldemort's Horcruxes because she wouldn't feel right if she didn't have it with her, the information in the book seems more like a supplement to the information in her mind, rather than an extension of her mind. What makes Otto's notebook different from these and other ordinary cases is the way it's integrated into his daily functioning. Even though the information kept in the notebook is external to his body, he always has his notebook with him, and he always consults it when trying to recall information. When using his notebook, he immediately accepts the information within it. There are no deep respects in which the information in the notebook is different from the information in our memories, except for the fact that it's stored outside the boundaries of Otto's skull and skin. According to Clark and Chalmers, that one difference alone isn't enough to keep the information in Otto's notebook from being part of his mind. Mischief managed. Suppose, for the sake of argument, that we accept the extended mind idea. Now consider Fred and George Weasley's connection to the Marauder's map they stole from Argus Filch's office in their first year at Hogwarts. Until they later bequeath it to Harry, they rely on it so heavily in their escapades that it wouldn't be much of a stretch to see their relationship to it as analogous to Otto's relationship to his notebook. The problem, however, is that there are two of them. If the map becomes not only part of Fred's extended mind, but also part of George's extended mind, then the twins share even more in common than we'd realised. Their minds actually overlap. This suggests one of the potentially disturbing ramifications of the extended mind idea. Once we accept that the minds extend beyond the boundaries of skin and skull, we open up the possibility that it extends into someone else's mind. When this overlap occurs, we don't need to be skilled at legitimacy to have the ability to extract thoughts from another person's mind. Those thoughts may already be part of our own. A related worry is the potential threat that an extended mind poses to one's sense of self. Compared to the ordeals that Harry Potter has to endure, and the greatness he achieves in spite of them, both the trials and the triumphs experienced by most witches and wizards, and certainly most muggles and squibs, seem trivial. But just as Harry's experiences make him the person he is, the personal experiences that each of us undergoes make us who we are. Many philosophers endorse some version of the memory theory of personal identity, which dates back at least to the British philosopher John Locke, 1632 to 1704. According to this theory, our continuing identity over time consists in the continuity of memory. It's the chains of memory connecting them that makes the adult Harry who watches his children board the Hogwarts Express the same person as the teenager who faces Voldemort in the Forbidden Forest, and the same person as the orphaned infant taken in by the Dursleys. According to the memory theory, our memories are at the very foundations of our identities. If these same memories can be shared with someone else, and can even become part of someone else, then how do we know who we really are? At various times during his Hogwarts career, Harry shares the memories of several other individuals, including three of his professors, Dumbledore, Snape, and Slughorn. And indeed, in almost every instance, he is greatly affected by his forays into the Pensieve. Tortured by the look he got via Snape's memory of his own father's arrogant and unappealing behaviour while at Hogwarts, Harry reevaluates not only his sense of his father, but also his sense of himself. For nearly 5 years, the thought of his father had been a source of comfort, of inspiration. Whenever someone had told him he was like James, he had glowed with pride inside. And now he felt cold and miserable at the thought of him. When he learns, again from Snape's memory, that a part of Voldemort's soul lives within himself, he's forced to reshape his sense of his place in the world. Finally, the truth. Harry understood at last that he was not supposed to survive. In each of these cases, Harry's use of the Pensieve leads to a sort of identity crisis. But now, think about what else can happen in the wizarding world. Physical appearance can be replicated via Polyjuice Potion. Memories can be almost completely erased by a flick of the wand and an incantation of Obliviate. False memories can also be implanted. Each of these magical possibilities poses a great threat to the integrity of an individual's identity, much greater, in fact, than the threat of memory sharing via Pensieve. When Barty Crouch Jr. imprisons Moody in a trunk and uses Polyjuice Potion to impersonate him, he's really engaged in identity theft. Gilderoy Lockhart steals countless identities via memory charms before becoming his own victim through his use of a malfunctioning wand. Hermione has much purer motives when she tampers with her parents' memories, making them believe that they're Wendell and Monica Wilkins, a childless couple fulfilling their lifelong dream of moving to Australia. But her good intentions don't change the fact that her actions deprive the Grangers of their identities. Clearly, Harry's experiences with the Pensieve don't fall into this same category. What makes his previous experiences with the Pensieve so difficult is the content of the memories he shared, not the memory sharing itself. Seeing Snape's worst memory is an unpleasant experience for Harry because of the painful facts it reveals, not because it somehow causes his identity to merge with that of the potions master. Had Snape been a good storyteller, and had Harry been able to trust him, the same awful knowledge that Harry gains from the Pensieve could theoretically have been gained from an oral recounting. Using the Pensieve is more effective because it allows Harry to see the past events for himself, and is more objective because Snape's own testimony would probably be tinged with sneering subjectivity. But in principle, any knowledge conveyed via the Pensieve could be conveyed another way. Lumos. There are several different sorts of memories. Some are know-how memories, memories of skill, as when an aging wizard who hasn't used a broomstick since his Quidditch days remembers how to ride it. Some are factual memories, as when Hermione can report the properties of the mandrake during herbology. Distinct from both of these are experiential memories, memories from the first-person point of view, as when Harry remembers the searing pain caused by Dolores Umbridge's quill as it carved words into his right hand. The memories that Otto keeps in his notebook are factual memories. When memory theorists invoke memory and explanations of personal identity, however, they're interested in first-person, experiential memories. It is important to note that memories reviewed in a Pensieve are not of this sort. The Pensieve replays memories from the third-person perspective. When Dumbledore thinks about the trial and sentencing of Bellatrix Lestrange, his memory is presumably from the personal perspective he had on it at the time, from his seat on the highest bench in the gallery of spectators. But when he reviews the memory in the Pensieve, The memory no longer has this, or any, particular point of view. In fact, given what we know about the Pensieve, the memory that Dumbledore shares with Harry should already be shared by all of the spectators at Lestrange's trial. These facts about the Pensieve are crucial for understanding why its use poses no threat to our individual identities. What's important for personal identity are our first-person memories. Just as using a time-turner to revisit past events doesn't jeopardize who you are, neither does sharing memories via a Pensieve. And just as sharing an experience with someone else doesn't threaten your sense of self, sharing one of your memories in a Pensieve with someone else shouldn't either. This also sheds light, more broadly, on why we needn't be threatened by the thesis of the extended mind. The mind is indeed mysterious, and there's much about it we don't know. But one thing that we can be sure of is that whether your thoughts are kept in a Pensieve, in a mind, or in your notebook, those thoughts are still your own. The Pensieve is a truly magical device, and if I ever see one come up for auction on eBay, I'll bid on it without hesitation or limit. Still, however magical it is, it can't make you someone you're not. Chapter 15. A Hogwarts Education. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Gregory Basham. What kid wouldn't love to go to Hogwarts? Boarding school in a really cool castle, tons of adventures, great camaraderie, and a sense of belonging. Wonderful all-you-can-eat meals, roast beef, roast chicken, pork chops and lamb chops, sausages, bacon and steak, boiled potatoes, roast potatoes, fries, Yorkshire pudding. And best of all, no boring math, French or science classes. Pretty much all you learn is how to do magic. You learn how to fly, to travel instantly from point to point, to conjure things out of thin air, to transfigure objects into whatever you want them to be, to make potions that cure diseases or bring good luck, to defend yourself against dark wizards, creepy dementors, and obnoxious gits like Draco Malfoy. Heck, Hogwarts is like a camp for future superheroes. From a kid's point of view, what could be cooler? What seems cool to a kid, though, may not seem so swift to an adult or to a philosopher. What would great educational thinkers, philosophers such as Plato, Aristotle, Kant and John Dewey, say about teaching and learning at Hogwarts? Is Hogwarts a model school, as Susan Engel, the director of the program in teaching at Williams College, has claimed? Or are there real problems with Hogwarts academics that need to be addressed? Here, we'll look at the pros and cons of a Hogwarts education through the lenses of both classic philosophers of education and contemporary educational research. The good. The philosopher John Dewey, 1859 to 1952, was the most influential thinker in American education. Early in the 20th century, Dewey criticized traditional education for its stress on passive listening, rote memorization, undemocratic values, and disconnect with practical real-life concerns. In opposition to traditional education, Dewey advocated a progressive approach to teaching and learning that emphasized three features that have now been widely adopted in American education: hands-on learning, building on the natural interests of children, and connecting schoolwork to everyday life. One of the clear strengths of education at Hogwarts is that it reflects these three progressivist ideals. Hands-on learning. As we've seen, kids don't come to Hogwarts to learn calculus or Spanish or world history. They come to learn how to do magic. And by this yardstick, Hogwarts is clearly a successful school. Most of its students do learn loads of useful potions and spells, pass their owls and newts, and graduate as capable magicians. How do students learn so effectively? Not through listening to Professor Binns's boring lectures on the history of magic, or by reading Professor Umbridge's purely theoretical textbook assignments. Instead, they learn to do magic in an apprentice-like way that typically involves 1. Demonstration of a magical technique by a skilled teacher. 2. Practice of the technique by the students. 3. Individualized coaching by the instructor to correct faults. And 4. Continued practice by the students until the technique is mastered. nearly all of the examples of effective pedagogy in the Potter books. For instance, Remus Lupin's teaching Harry how to conjure a Patronus, or Harry's teaching of defensive magic to Dumbledore's army, involve this kind of hands-on learning by doing. Given that magic is portrayed in the Potter series as a hard-to-acquire skill that can be mastered only through coaching and practice, this kind of teaching makes perfect sense. Building on the natural interests of children. Dewey believed that children are naturally active and curious, and he urged educators to use kids' natural interests and real-life experiences as hooks to encourage learning. Research has shown that students are more engaged and learn more when they study things they find interesting and relevant. Hogwarts students are clearly eager to learn magic. They love having magical abilities and enjoy developing those abilities and learning new spells and skills. Moreover, they clearly understand the practical value of what they're learning. When Umbridge won't allow her Defense Against the Dark Arts students to practice defensive magic, the pupils organise their own class to practice on their own. They know that learning to do defensive magic is vital to their success on school exams, in their lives and careers after Hogwarts, and to their efforts as part of Dumbledore's army to thwart Voldemort's return to power. Connecting schoolwork to everyday life. Too often, Dewey believed, classwork is seen as a preparation for some remote and speculative future, rather than as a part of life itself. Learning the names of Uruguay's three largest rivers might be useful to some pupils, for example, if they plan to open a tugboat business there someday. But for most students, this information will be what the philosopher Alfred North Whitehead, 1861 to 1947, called inert knowledge, lumps of undigested, untested, unused information. Dewey believed that education has a practical function and should not be seen as a series of pointless hurdles to jump over before real life begins. Education isn't a preamble to life, it's part of life, and it exists to solve practical human problems and meet human needs. Some of what students learn at Hogwarts is pretty inert. For example, Harry and his friends can't see much point in Rubius Hagrid's lesson on raising ugly and dangerous blast-ended scroots, or Professor Trelawney's bogus crystal ball-gazing. But generally, students can recognise right away the practical payoff of what they're learning. They realise that when they leave Hogwarts, they will need to know how to apparate and disapparate, to transfigure objects, to defend themselves against dark wizards, and so forth. This makes them eager students and motivates them to learn. The bad. What's not to love about Hogwarts? As we've seen, the three real strengths of a Hogwarts education are that it encourages hands-on learning, builds on the natural interests of students, and teaches important real-life skills. There are other features of Hogwarts academics, however, that are not so attractive. Three major negatives are: the school is too dangerous, there are too few qualified teachers, students don't get a well-rounded education. Let's look at these points one by one. Too dangerous. Let's face it, Hogwarts is a pretty hazardous place to go to school. It's located next to a magical forest, where unwary or reckless students may get eaten by giant spiders or set upon by hostile centaurs. There's an ice-cold lake next to the castle full of treacherous water demons, grindylows, and a giant squid. All kinds of lethal creatures, three-headed dogs, trolls, basilisks, may be on occasion be found in the school. There's a mischievous resident poltergeist, Peeves, who's constantly trying to trip students up or drop heavy objects onto their heads. Staircases contain vanishing steps that students need to remember to jump over. Unmindful students wandering near the Forbidden Forest may be pounded to a pulp by the Whomping Willow. Students sometimes work with dangerous magical creatures. Professor Kettleburn retires at the end of Harry's second year in order to spend more time with his remaining limbs. Potions often go awry and injure or disfigure students. The most popular game at Hogwarts, Quidditch, can easily result in serious injuries to players. The Triwizard Tournament involves three high-risk challenges, and even the youngest students carry potentially lethal weapons, wands, that they regularly use to hex and jinx one another. True, many injuries that students suffer at Hogwarts can be healed quickly by Severus Snape's potions or Madame Pomfrey's skilled nursing care, but not all injuries can be cured, or cured quickly, by magical means. And as Albus Dumbledore says, no magic can reawaken the dead. Granted, the Potter books are only fiction, and all of this danger and violence makes for exciting stories. But you can bet that if Hogwarts really existed, the WTA, Wizard Teacher Association, would be up in arms. Unqualified teachers. Hogwarts teachers are a mixed bag. There are good teachers who are competent, caring and fair. These include Albus Dumbledore, Minerva McGonagall, Phileas Fitwick, Pomona Sprout, and Remus Lupin. Other teachers are fairly decent, but have significant shortcomings. These include Hagrid, who is knowledgeable and engaging, but can't resist exposing his students to dangerous creatures. Moody Crouch, who teaches his students loads, but unfortunately, as Dean Thomas notes, turns out to be a disguised homicidal maniac. And Snape, who certainly knows his stuff, but is bullying, sarcastic, and blatantly biased in favour of Slytherin students. There are also downright crummy teachers at Hogwarts. The four worst, if you don't count the Death Eaters who briefly join the faculty in Deathly Hallows, are Binns, Sybil Trelawney, Gilderoy Lockhart, and Dolores Umbridge. Binns, a ghost, who apparently doesn't know that he's dead, regularly puts his History of Magic students to sleep with his droning lectures, doesn't know the names of his pupils, and is barely aware that there are actually any students in his classes. Trelawney is an old fraud who teaches a woolly subject, divination, and enjoys predicting her students' early and gruesome deaths. Lockhart is a narcissistic and ineffectual blowhard. And Umbridge, of course, is a twisted, power-hungry racial supremacist who tries to undermine any effective education at the school. Dumbledore has great difficulties hiring qualified faculty at Hogwarts. Mostly, this isn't his fault. After Professor Quirrell's shocking demise, we're told that no one would take the job of Defence Against the Dark Arts teacher, except the hapless Lockhart. Yet the larger problem, as Arthur E. Levine notes, is that the wizarding world has no teacher education programmes or certification requirements. Apparently, anybody can teach at Hogwarts, including those with little or no formal magical education, such as Fiorenzi or Hagrid. Without effective teacher training and credentialing procedures, teacher quality at the Wizarding School is bound to be sketchy and even pose risks to students. No well-rounded education. If Harry and his friends were attending a Muggle British boarding school, they would have classes in subjects such as English, history, science, geography, music, mathematics, foreign languages, physical education, citizenship, and religious education. At Hogwarts, the only thing students learn is how to do magic. Why is this a problem? Because Hogwarts offers a narrow and vocationally oriented education. It provides its students with the tools of power, but not the wisdom to use them. As the noted philosopher of education Mortimer Adler, 1902 to 2001, remarked, a good secondary school should prepare its students to do three things: to earn a living in an intelligent and responsible fashion, to function as intelligent and responsible citizens, and to make both of these things serve the purpose of leading intelligent and responsible lives, to enjoy as fully as possible all the goods that make a human life as good as it can be. Hogwarts is devoted almost exclusively to the first of these three goals, vocational training. It teaches its students how to make a living in the wizarding world, but not how to live. What is the aim of education? Great educational thinkers have defended various views. For Plato, the first great philosopher of education in Western civilization, the purpose of education is to achieve wisdom, goodness, and a just and well-ordered society. For Plato's pupil Aristotle, education should promote human fulfillment, eudaimonia, which he defined as a life filled with intrinsically excellent activities, especially purely intellectual activities. John Locke, 1632 to 1704, claimed that virtue and wisdom are the great business of education. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, 1712 to 1778, advocated a natural, child-centered education aimed at producing happy, virtuous citizens, uncorrupted by the hypocrisies and false values of civilization. Immanuel Kant believed that character development, becoming a good moral person who wills the right things for the right reasons, is the primary aim of education. Even John Dewey, who, as we've seen, criticized traditional education for its disconnect with real-world concerns, argued that the ultimate aim of education is simply more education or growth in one's capacity for enriching experiences. An educated person should be able to write and speak well, think critically, and be well grounded in the sciences and the humanities that form the foundation of a liberal education. The goal of a liberal education is not to help students get a good job, but to impart the knowledge, skills, and dispositions needed to fulfill one's human potential, to understand and appreciate the supreme productions of human thought and art, and to live a rich, full, and vibrant life. A good secondary school should lay the foundation for such a liberal education. Above all, as Adler noted, it should seek to impart to its students both the skills of learning and the wish to learn, so that in adult life they will want to go on learning and will have the skills to use in the process. Because there are no universities in the wizarding world, it is critical that secondary wizarding schools, such as Hogwarts, encourage and equip their students to become lifelong learners. Yet Hogwarts clearly fails in this regard. At Hogwarts, Harry and his friends are taught how to perform spells and brew potions. They are not taught to love reading or ideas, to think scientifically, to appreciate art and literature, or to reflect in an informed and disciplined way about the problems of society and the human condition. Of course, not all education at a residential school like Hogwarts takes place in the classroom, and Harry and his friends learn many important life lessons outside formal class settings. In fact, Harry's most important teacher and role model at Hogwarts is clearly Dumbledore, although he isn't one of Harry's regular instructors. For Harry, Ron Weasley, Hermione Granger, Neville Longbottom, Ginny Weasley, Luna Lovegood, and their circle, Hogwarts does prove to be a kind of school of virtue of the sort that ancient philosophers praised. In assessing the value of a Hogwarts education, it's important to keep in mind what is learned both inside and outside the classroom. My point is simply that Hogwarts' formal curriculum is too narrow and vocational. Remember that most Hogwarts students have relatively little contact with Dumbledore during their years at the school. Harry may pick up priceless nuggets of wisdom in Dumbledore's office, but for most Hogwarts students, it's what they learn, or fail to learn, in the classroom that makes the greatest difference in their lives. Some might argue that people with magical powers don't really need a well-rounded liberal education, that they can find happiness and achieve their life goals without one. Besides, they might say, any serious misuse of magic will likely be detected and severely punished by the Ministry of Magic. This misses the point of a liberal education, however. A liberal education is one suited to a free individual. It liberates the mind by enlarging its perspective, refining its sensibilities, and freeing it from ignorance and the limitations of one's time, place, and culture. As Adler said, a proper education cultivates a person's capability for mental growth and moral development, and helps her acquire the intellectual and moral virtues requisite for a good human life. The Hogwarts curriculum is not well suited to provide the broad-based knowledge, the intellectual skills, and the solid character virtues that a good school, wizarding or muggle, should seek to impart. Because of the narrow vocational education they receive, Hogwarts students are ill-equipped to deal with the many problems that confront wizarding society, including, as Hermione says, this horrible thing wizards have of thinking they're superior to other creatures. The ugly. This horrible thing is, in fact, the greatest problem wizards face. The Potter books are a morality tale about a wizard civil war. On one side, are Voldemort's racial supremacists, who want wizards to rule over muggles, and pure-blooded wizards to rule over those of mixed ancestry. On the other side are Dumbledore and those who reject such radical supremacist views and believe instead in the basic equality of all rational, or at least all human, creatures on Earth. I say this is the biggest problem wizards face, not only because of the repulsiveness of such racial elitism, but because of what is at stake. Totalitarianism, thought control, secret police, mock trials, racial cleansing, all are real possibilities if the supremacists win. And, of course, they nearly do win in the Potter books, just as the Nazis nearly won in World War II. So, what is Dumbledore doing to educate Hogwarts students about the dangers and the irrationality of racial supremacism? Not a heck of a lot, at least not directly. True, Hogwarts is open to all students with magical powers, regardless of ancestry, race or social class, and Dumbledore makes a point of being an equal opportunity employer, hiring half-bloods such as Snape, and members of marginalised groups such as half-giants Hagrid, centaurs, Firenze, and werewolves, Lupin. But that's about it. There are, so far as we are told, no class discussions on racism, no workshops, no school assemblies on the topic. Racial slurs are rampant at Hogwarts, but no student is ever disciplined for using one. The fact that Hogwarts houses the largest population of oppressed house elves in England is nowhere mentioned in the 1,000 pages of Hogwarts: A History, and Hermione's efforts to alleviate the house elves' plight are given no public support from Dumbledore. Most seriously, Dumbledore does nothing to remedy the great festering source of militant pure-bloodism at Hogwarts, Slytherin House. Slytherin is a breeding ground for dark wizards. As Hagrid says, when Voldemort rose to power, there wasn't a single witch or wizard who went bad who wasn't in Slytherin. And this is no accident. Students are sorted into Slytherin because they will use any means to achieve their ends. Because people, especially impressionable children, tend to become like those they associate with, Slytherin is a hothouse of racial intolerance. It is also, inevitably, a source of fifth columnists in Hogwarts. Students whose ultimate loyalties aren't to Dumbledore or their classmates, but to Voldemort and his warped racist agenda. This cancer of racial intolerance and elitism is what is ugly about education at Hogwarts. The obvious question is why Dumbledore doesn't do more about it. In one sense, of course, he does do something hugely important about it. He works tirelessly and courageously to defeat Voldemort. But Voldemort was powerless for more than a decade after his failed attempt to kill Harry. Why didn't Dumbledore do anything to address the problems with Slytherin then? Maybe Dumbledore's hands were tied by school bylaws or the tradition-bound Hogwarts Board of Governors. Maybe he would have been fired if he had tried to take decisive action. Maybe, as Travis Prinzi argues, he was a libertarian gradualist who believed in changing hearts and minds by personal example and gentle persuasion rather than by coercive rules or policies. Who knows? There could be lots of reasons he refuses to take stronger action. I, for one, am happy to give him the benefit of the doubt. But it's a fair question, I think, whether Dumbledore shouldn't have done more than he did. Like Bertie Bott's Every Flavour Beans, a mix. Hogwarts, like most schools, has its pros and cons. Its students love the castle, the grounds, the camaraderie, the hands-on focus on practical magic. It's definitely a fun and interesting place to go to school. Yet there are also a few big negatives about a Hogwarts education, including some ineffective teachers, a dangerous environment, a narrow curriculum, and a strong undercurrent of racial intolerance and elitism. So, would I send my kid to Hogwarts? In the final analysis, yes, it's just too special an opportunity to miss. But I'd also be sure, as I do, to teach my child about the fundamental equality of persons, the vital role of democratic freedoms, and the importance of a well-rounded education. For these are the values that can make our world a truly magical place. Part 4.